Well, I guess I'll start with an update, Tommy. You know, when we're in Turkey doing these UES consultations, and after we have that little bite after an evening for dinner, and you think that we really go back and work, we're actually going back to my room where there's a bottle of scotch. So that's one update. You know, Kerry is coming over to work in the ROW region. Callahan often refers to our region as the dark side. So, but we do welcome Kerry with open arms. He'll be coming over to our Tunis operations towards the end of March. With that said, I'll give you a rundown on the council's outreach in the ROW region. We have two country offices, one office located in Mexico City covering Mexico, and one located in Cairo, Egypt. We also have three regional offices, one located in Tunis, Tunisia, that covers Europe and Africa and the Mediterranean Basin, one in Amman, Jordan, covering the Middle East as well as the Indian subcontinent, and our newest office, which Kurt Schultz is heading up, is in Panama City. We actually signed a lease agreement this past week for our office space. That office will be covering Latin America as well as the Caribbean Basin. And to support our efforts in key markets where we have marketing programs, we have contracted with 13 representatives. Four of those representatives are here with us at this meeting today, and you'll have an opportunity to visit with them during lunch. Moving on into programs. You know, you can really take the council programs and divide it up into four strategic areas. We have programs that are focused on addressing market access issues, such as import duties. We have programs focused on market development. These would be in countries where there really aren't any market access issues, so what we're really focused on is getting more mouths in the trough. We have programs that are focused on market defense. I would have to say that we probably have been no more challenged in this area in terms of trying to maintain market share than we have this past year. And I'll elaborate a little more on that later in my presentation. We also have a program that I guess we call Gathering Market Intelligence, but what that's really about is it empowers staff to get out into the field and try to identify the new market opportunities to export U.S. feed grains in the future. To start with market access, as Tommy mentioned, the staff have been working quite hard over the past couple of months devising programs that would be implemented in the next 24 months. This is a summary of programs in the ROW region that we plan to present to the ROW and the value-added and the biotech aid teams over the course of this afternoon and tomorrow. What I'd like to focus on is just Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is interesting, and the reason it falls under the market access area is because of a subsidy schedule that the Saudis have. You know, the Saudis are bent on providing low-cost feed ingredients to their livestock and poultry industries. And they do this through the subsidizing the importation of feed ingredients. For a long time, the primary feed grains that were being subsidized by the Saudi government consisted of corn and barley. In the area of barley, Saudi trades 50% of all the barley traded around the world. Huge barley importers, 7 million tons. But several years ago, 2 years ago, when we saw a spike in international market prices for feed ingredients, the Saudi government began to realize, hey, you know, we're not quite sure we can continue to provide this level of subsidy for barley as we had in the past. And so in reaction to that, they decided to add another ingredient to their subsidy schedule, and it was grain sorghum. Now, grain sorghum is quite interesting in that the Saudis haven't been quite sure of what amount of subsidy to apply to grain sorghum. When they first put grain sorghum on their subsidy list, they actually established a two-tier subsidy. They had a subsidy for grain sorghum that contained 11% or more protein, and then they had a subsidy for sorghum that contained 7% protein. So really what they were trying to distinguish here was between, at least what we believe, was between tannin and non-tannin sorghum. The reason I say what we believe is because the system of putting into place the subsidies is not very transparent. But over the course of time, the Saudis, you can see in the column to the right side of the screen in March of 2008, I used at the bottom here a 94% tariff spread between, I'm using corn, yellow corn, as the basis. So there was a 94% spread between the subsidies of corn and sorghum. 11 months later, in October of 2008, the government revised their subsidy schedule, and they made it actually where sorghum received a higher import subsidy than corn. The following month, they did another adjustment, brought it down to 102% of corn. And then in January of this past year, they revised the schedule again and brought sorghum down to 83% of the subsidy of corn. Now, what's really unique about this is that in the process of dropping that tariff down to 83%, they also did away with the two-tier subsidy schedule. In other words, they eliminated the tier that applied to any sorghum that contained 11% or more protein. And so they pegged everything at 7%. This, in effect, has locked the United States out of the market. There is absolutely no opportunity for the U.S. to sell sorghum into Saudi Arabia so long as we have the subsidy being based off of a 7% protein. And that's key here because the Saudis, from our understanding, utilize the nutritive values of feed ingredients to develop, to determine the amount of subsidy that they will provide. So this coming next couple of years, or this year and in 2011, we'll be focused on working with the Saudis to try to get them to reestablish a two-tier system or some sort of a system that enables opportunities for sorghum to move into this market. I also highlighted DDG on this because at present, distillers dried grains is not on the subsidy schedule. And so that is another area that we'll be working with the Saudi government to try to get that commodity listed. In the area of market development, an example here, we're going to have 12 programs that we'll be presenting to the A-teams, but one of them is Nigerian sorghum. You know, Nigeria has the largest population of any country on the African continent, about 140 million people. In the 1980s, the Nigerian government put a ban on the importation of feed grains. No importation of barley, corn, or sorghum. The reason they did this is because they instituted a policy of self-sufficiency, and they thought by banning the importation of feed grains, it would stimulate domestic production. This ban on feed grains existed up until last year. And last year, the Nigerian government removed its ban on importation of feed ingredients. Kurt Schultz and I had an opportunity to travel to Nigeria this past fall, and one of the groups that we met was Guinness Brewery, one of the two major breweries in Nigeria. And what makes Guinness interesting, you see I have sorghum here, and you're probably scratching your head saying, well, isn't beer made out of barley? Well, in Nigeria, it's not. It was prior to their 1980 ban, but the breweries there shifted their processes and started utilizing domestically produced grain sorghum. And Kurt and I, well, not me, but Kurt being a connoisseur of beer tells me that the beer in Nigeria is quite good. Is that right, Kurt? It's a clear beer. The breweries over there use in excess of 200,000 tons of sorghum in their brewing process. What also makes Nigeria quite interesting is that 85% of the grain sorghum produced in Nigeria, and Nigeria produces over 10 million tons of sorghum, over 85% is a non-tannin variety, the same that we produce in the United States. And so there is an opportunity here to ship U.S. non-tannin sorghum to Nigeria. Why do I say there's an opportunity? Because Guinness Brewery is paying in excess of $400 a ton for sorghum purchased locally. And just doing some rough math, you can even calculate that if they ship sorghum to Nigeria in containers, we'd still be price competitive. So we've already sent them a sample of U.S. yellow sorghum. They are running some trials with it. We anticipate this coming spring to actually bring Guinness breweries to the United States and show them a little more about the U.S. sorghum industry. So that's an example of a market development program that the council has working. In the area of market defense, I pick on Morocco a little bit. For so long, we've enjoyed a handsome market share in Morocco, in excess of 80%. And all was well and good up until here this last couple of years. And in fact, this past year, our market share fell to below 50%. One of the things that we know about Morocco is that there are about five major importers of corn. One of the importers imports over 40 million bushels a year. But all of these importers buy on what's called an optional origin CNF basis. And what this means is that the buyers in Morocco are not in the position to make a decision on where that corn is going to originate from. It's left in the hands of the suppliers. And typically, the suppliers that the Moroccans are working with are European-based suppliers. And so, here a couple of weeks ago, one of the suppliers actually told a Moroccan, "I'm not able to deliver what you want, the quality you want from the United States." So this is a supplier, a major supplier in Morocco, telling this to a Moroccan feed miller. And of course, it's a small enough industry that word spreads quite rapidly. And so what we are going to be focusing a lot of energy on is trying to work with the Moroccans to change the way that they buy, moving them away from optional origin, CNF, to FOB. We basically want the Moroccans to be in a position to make the decision on where this grain originates from. Number two, the Grains Council actually has more influence on the Moroccan buyers than we do on the European suppliers. And so that's going to be one of the programs that we'll be working on. We believe that by the Moroccans buying FOB, they'll be able to get the quality they want for the price they're willing to pay. I'm also going to bring up here real quickly Central America grain quality. Over the past several years, I guess the credibility factor for the U.S. grain inspection system has wavered in Central America, primarily because the buyers in Central America, the feed millers, when they get their grain delivered to them, they say this is not number two corn, but yet the export certificate that we have says what was loaded on that vessel met number two specifications. I think the primary issue here is broken kernels. A lot of these Central Americans are starting to get the feel that as a result of the broken kernels, there may be an impact on feed performance for livestock and poultry. So one of the things that we're going to be working on is trying to educate the Central American buyers about U.S. grain inspection procedures, trying to work with them to harmonize how they sample and test grain at arrival with those that are being utilized in the United States when the grain is loaded. Now, we may not actually get the Central Americans to become harmonized, but the end game here really is to make sure that the Central Americans, if they have a perception that grain quality or broken kernel is going to affect broiler performance, if it's just a perception, we want to correct that. If it's a real problem, then they may have something that they can deal with and using tools of trade, such as putting some extra language in their contracts. Overall, what we'll be presenting to the aid teams over the course of the next 2 days are 7 access programs, 13 market development programs, and 11 market defense programs. I've highlighted here the gathering of market intelligence because I can't really put a number on the number of new markets that we plan to uncover over the next year, but safe to say that there will be quite a few. And with that said, I'll turn it over to Hussein.